Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
It's getting harder and harder to control what your kids see and hear these days, isn't it?
I think a lot of parents would agree with you, not just because we have, you know, screens that are everywhere, but how they're being used and with what real understanding of the long-term consequences. And we've talked about that in terms of what may follow someone over time, mm-hmm. but, you know, that the wounds that we can inflict by saying things and posting things, that's a little different, and we've been taking that apart for several years now, too, and not just what happens when one child bullies another.
Yeah, things that are impossible to quantify, really.
Well, there are those who are trying to and who are trying to stem the damage that mm-hmm. that can cause. Now, we're far from the days when a screen meant a TV and how you saw a movie or the thing in your window to keep the bugs out. Mobile devices of all types have put screens in reach for so many kids for well over a decade and changed the nature of relationships. Instant access to peers, social media sites, and media of all types has brought out the dark side of communication. Justine Finn works to stem it. She's the director of RelationShift, a project that was founded at the Harvard Innovation Lab to work with middle and high school students. She's on Hawaii Island this week. She joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, thanks. And hope you are, too, and enjoying being over there on Hawaii Island as we're over here in Honolulu on Oahu. It doesn't matter whether we're separated by water or not, or countries or not, the idea that so much can be simply brought into your hand or to your desk is a fact that we all now live with. But especially when it comes to kids and teens, have you seen any shift at all in the last couple of years in the way the sensitivity to that has grown or changed?
Yeah, so what I'm seeing is more and more parents are becoming alarmed and schools are becoming alarmed about the impact that this is having on the way we connect as human beings. So what does our family meal look like? What is that car ride, you know, maybe between soccer practice and school, which was an opportunity for conversations about how did the day go? What's your relationship like? Now we're on our screens. So we're having these conversations about how is it changing our lives. And more younger and younger children are having access to their own devices. So maybe 5 years ago, you used mom's iPad. Maybe, 7 years ago, you used the family computer. But we're finding that kids need access to their own devices in order to just finish their homework. So that's creating new challenges as far as exposure to violent or sexual images or problematic material, as well as social media, which is really putting a lot of parents and schools in difficult places.
There are, well, at least there are those who think that, you shouldn't have screens in your car. And yet we see minivans that have a drop down screen. So ostensibly a child could watch a movie or try to, keep the "are we there yet" comments to a minimum. But having screens everywhere seems to be also isolating kids and families more and more, making some of those conversations that you would like to have with them about their communication devices and how they relate to other people more difficult. How have you begun to change your message to parents from what they've been hearing from people like Common Sense Media, which is for many years now talked to parents about making good media choices for their kids? Sometimes you're not there to make the choice.
Absolutely. So what I see, conversations with parents, with schools, there's a lot of desire to control how much time your child is on the device. There's kind of this focus on the monitoring. And Deb Nordheitner, she focuses on this work, uses this phrase, which is mentor, don't monitor. So instead of being worried, hey, kids on average are using 9 hours of screen time, not including for school or homework a day, these parents are saying, hey, I'm going to get my kid down to 5 hours of screen time. What I'm encouraging folks to think about is, what are your children doing when they're using those screens? What are the messages they're consuming? What are they looking at? What videos? So some of the hard news is the average age children are being exposed to pornographic material is age 8. And I'm so sorry to share this news with parents on a beautiful Thursday morning. But you need to be mindful when you give your kid a device or let them spend some time alone with that device. It's not if they'll be exposed to violent or sexual material, but when. And so it's really preparing them to understand these messages and be able to come to you and have a conversation when they are exposed. So it's really mentoring them through the relationship with those devices, with those medias, so that they can develop those healthy identities and relationships to others.
There are blockers. Are those not working as well?
You know, kids are brilliant. So I'll share a quick story. My 3-year-old niece, a few years back, she told me that she liked to watch Curious George on her laptop. And her mom would let her look on YouTube. But then she would sneak. She would find a way to go from Curious George, which is quite harmless and positive, to watch Bratz. And Bratz shows feature, you know, kind of glamorous, a little bit sexy kind of Barbie characters who have a lot of drama. She didn't know how to, you know, type or read, but she could get what she wanted. And so our teens and our tweens are very sophisticated, often more than we are, at finding what they want. So we, you know, I've heard someone say we want to be able to outsource our parenting, have an app do the work for us. But when I talk to kids, they say, yeah, we know how to get around that. We know how to get around that device. I think it can be helpful for a conversation, but I don't encourage parents to spy on their kids. I think it's really important for them to think through and help their kids develop consciousness around what they're consuming, help their children make better decisions for themselves.
Justine, that seems awfully tough to do when you're talking about, for example, with your niece, a 3-year-old.
Yes.
So what's a parent to do? Because, I mean, this is a different way of being able to protect your child or to be able to prepare your child than, say, if you were talking to a middle schooler and you're really looking at the issue of bullying.
Exactly. So it's really challenging to do, and I think some apps can be fantastic. There are things you can put on your server at home to ensure that less porn, less dangerous or violent content comes through. So I do recommend some of those, but I don't want parents to stop there. I really want you to have those conversations. And one thing we're seeing, Beth Ann, is something called joint media engagement, which is watching the shows with your young people, sitting side by side, say, hey, show me what you love about Snapchat. What do you enjoy about Instagram? Even if your kids are playing 5 hours a day of those violent video games, sit and play with them. And research shows that even if you don't have those difficult conversations, but you're just there, it mitigates the impact, the negative impact that it has on your child, and gets them to be a little bit more conscious about what they're consuming.
So what do you do when a parent is there with a child saying, this is, you know, pretty horrendous stuff, and they're appalled at what may be coming through? And also, is a kid who is, you know, 9, 10, 11 going to really sit there with mom or dad and be comfortable to do that as opposed to saying, thanks, mom, bye?
Yeah. You know, and this is what I see. I see different stuff from different parents. One thing I've heard is get curious, not furious. So if you see your kids consuming certain things or posting certain pictures, instead of just taking away the device, shutting it down, and making it even more attractive to them because it's now forbidden, ask them what motivated you to, you know, share that message about yourself. What is inspiring to you about this? And then I've seen a lot of families use media contracts where they sit down with everyone and they write out a contract in agreement on how we will use media, what hours. And if it's co-created, you can get buy-in from the children and the family. And another thing, Beth Ann, a lot of parents, they give their kids a device not realizing that their entire parenting style will have to shift and revolve around that device. So before you get your kid that device, talk through what your expectations are. So when you take it away or when you limit it, it won't feel like you're taking away a right, but you're offering a privilege.
For older kids who are middle school, high school age, where it's not a matter of what comes to them, perhaps, you know, inadvertently, but it's what they seek to do with it that can be harmful to someone well beyond that moment or those years of school. What are you telling parents now about talking to kids of how they can wound?
Like being empathetic and having sensitivity and kind of a moral compass when it comes to social media. Well, you know, the thing is, the same issues we had 10 years ago, 15 years ago with bullying, with sexual harassment, all this stuff, as you know, we're just seeing elevated to this wider stage. And it's so tempting to share that photo or make that little nudge because you often will go up in your social capital. So I think parents, it's the same hard work of raising children who have a sense of justice, a sense of a moral identity where they see the outcome of their peers is similar to the outcome of themselves, and really sitting down and talking through them the consequences of what might happen to them and their community. There's some great documentaries on this they can show their kids as well.
We got to go in just about a minute, but here we are in a very changed political climate where we don't necessarily have a great deal of empathy being, you know, perpetuated. Are you changing some of how you're approaching parents given the fact that we've seen such great political change?
Yes, the biggest thing is model it yourself. And it's harder to do than to say, but get into the community, do more community service, give your children real life access to lives of difference from their own. It's one thing to watch or to see it on Instagram or BuzzFeed. It's another thing to be in the community, getting your hands dirty, engaging with others. And that's where we build those skills. And that's where we build that empathy and that real desire to make a difference.
Bottom line, get out of the screen or off the screen and get into real life.
Exactly. And get into conversation. Talk about the difficult stuff. I know it's awkward, but I'm telling you, kids tell me they're begging for more of that mentorship. They want you to talk to them about sex, as weird as it may be, and they want you to be there for them. Even if they react weirdly, I'm telling you, this is what they tell me behind the scenes.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and hope you will have a continued good trip over there on the Big Island, and we know that you'll be speaking there on Friday night. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Bethan. Take care.
Justine Finn is the director of RelationShift. It was founded at the Harvard Innovation Lab. RelationShift works with middle and high schools to address relationship issues and sexual violence. On Friday, Hawaii Preparatory Academy is hosting a public screening of the Netflix original film Audrey and Daisy. It'll be followed by a discussion with Justine Finn about social and other media and bullying. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the Plantation Days on stage. But before that, here's your backyard quiz.
Coming up, we'll be hearing about a series of plays to be performed in Hawaii's Plantation Village. The Plantation Village is a 50-acre outdoor museum in Waipahu, Oahu, that allows visitors to step back in time and experience the life of a late 19th century plantation worker. Guides provide tours of more than 25 authentic plantation homes, highlighting the lives of Hawaiian, Chinese, Japanese, Filipino, Korean, Okinawan, Portuguese, and Puerto Rican workers. The Plantation Village is also known for providing another experience, supernatural encounters. The village is believed by many to be haunted, with guests and tour guides alike reporting interactions with spirits or ghosts. For today's backyard quiz, which building on Hawaii's Plantation Village is home to the most reported paranormal activity? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, currently raising funds for a new kidney resource center in Kapolei and for the Senator Daniel K. Akaka Community Center, kidneyhi.org.
It isn't often that a theater artist is given an opportunity to write and design a piece for a specific setting, but that's what three young playwrights have done with the Leeward Theater production of Plantation Plays at Hawaii's Plantation Village in Waipahu. In each of their short plays, the setting is very much a part of the story, and project director Ashley DeMoville is with us for a preview. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning.
This is an interesting project because the audience walks through the set, and the set is there kind of all set up for you, isn't it?
Absolutely. They're in the village experiencing it along with the characters.
It's not often that a set is entirely built and ready before a word has been put on the page, is it?
It's fairly convenient, actually.
Yeah. Well, how did this all come about?
Well, about 2 years ago, Leeward Theater worked together with Playbuilders of Hawaii to produce the Waipahu Project. And as part of that production, we worked with Deanna Espinas at the Plantation Village. And that was kind of my first introduction to the Plantation Village. I'd never been before.
Mm-hmm.
And just working with the people there, being able to be at the village, kind of excited an interest in me and our theater manager, Kimiel. And we started experimenting and looking into ways to create an experience and to use that great venue to bring especially school children a little closer to the history of that time on the island.
Which is their history in that part of Oahu, I think, for a lot of them, right?
Exactly. Yep. So that was part of the big focus, is to look at early immigrants and how the work that they did and the big risks that they took in coming here impact the daily lives of kids today.
Have some of the kids in your project said, you know, this is reminds me of the stories my granddad told me and things like that?
Absolutely. And it's really nice to actually have we have a fairly large cast or collection of casts. Because we have so many performances, we actually have three completely separate casts of student actors that perform all the same shows.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the work that we've done in the room is gathering from their personal knowledge, stories from their grandparents, great-grandparents. And we've fed those into the plays. And so we've had the chance to adapt here and there what was written originally by the playwrights to make them really immediate as possible.
It sounds like a little bit of a collective authorship going on.
In a way, it is. We've taken things that we come up in the rehearsal room. Of course, we go and we talk to the playwrights. And they're all really, really excited to have that input and have given us pretty much free kind of liberty. One of the playwrights is actually performing in the plays as well. So she's always with us, which is nice.
Are the playwrights also students? Or are they from outside in the community? Or where'd you find them?
Well, one of the playwrights, Kiana Rivera, is a graduate student at the University of Hawaii at Manoa.
Mm-hmm.
And so she wrote the first of the three plays, Lost Boy. Our second writer is Courtney Takabayashi, and she is actually another instructor at Leeward Community College.
Mm-hmm.
Our third playwright, Kirsten Trombetta, she is in the education program at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and she was a student of ours at Leeward Community College.
So when you started putting the project together, did you sort of put out a call for, you know, who's got a script we can use, that kind of thing?
Well, we wanted to commission the plays from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
So we made a choice to look for playwrights that we thought would enjoy the opportunity and that we had some affiliation with at Leeward Community College. So instead of looking for existing plays, we went straight to a handful of playwrights and asked them to create a show. And we started, one of our first meetings was at the Plantation Village. And we did a tour with Deanna Espinas through all the different houses. And we talked to the three playwrights and said, we need to do research. We need to look at the history. We need to look at what is in the content standards for elementary schools now. And then we need to forget it all and write something that's fun and magical so that kids can enjoy the experience.
And as with children's theater, you want it to many children's plays are you know, sort of little parables or fables that lead to a very clear lesson. That's the case with these three, isn't it?
Absolutely. The goal is to try to hide that a little bit so that the kids immediately are just having fun through the whole thing. But in the end, they do learn some clear lessons.
Yeah.
They all center around immigration and the history of immigrants in this area of Oahu. But they have their own lessons within as well. The first play, Lost Boy, is about a kid who is playing on his iPod, and he's playing a game that's kind of alternative reality, and he's looking for these creatures and trying to catch them, much like a popular modern game now.
Sure.
And he falls into a time warp and kind of comes to in plantation days, and he doesn't know where he is or when he is.
Uh-huh.
And he encounters two other young children from this time in the early 20th century. And while looking for his iPod that he's now lost, they teach him about playing games together and how they can work together and have fun together playing games.
Yeah.
And how persistence pays off.
Which is a thread that runs through so many anecdotes of plantation days, you know.
Absolutely.
the different camps. We were all equally poor, right?
Yep.
So we made our own fun together.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that comes through pretty clear.
Yeah.
Another of the plays called Jan Schoda and the Case of the Missing Chicken. This one's geared toward our youngest audiences. And it's about a young girl in the Japanese camp looking for her missing chicken, her pet Mrs. Doodledoo, who has escaped.
Uh-huh.
And so she goes from house to house and she talks to her Filipino neighbor and her Portuguese neighbor. And in the process, she's looking for clues to find the chicken, but she also learns about what different cultures in Hawaii do with chicken.
Uh-huh.
She panics when she finds out that her Filipino neighbor is famous for his molungay chicken.
Uh-huh. As in that might have been the fate of hers, right?
Exactly. But there is a happy ending. So.
Well, that's a relief, not just for the chicken, but for,
exactly.
for all of us. Now, in the case of this play, the audience is walking from house to house.
Absolutely. We go with her as she goes and visits all these different neighbors. And it's just so wonderful to have this very immediate village we're walking through. And the history is with you. You're inside the history.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of times in theater, our job is to paint a picture. But now we're just filling in a picture that's already there,
yeah.
Which is so much fun.
Well, it also, you know, it opens up all kinds of possibilities, the idea of walking theater.
Absolutely.
For one thing, it would sort of counteract the numbness that some theater audiences get sitting for 4 hours through Hamlet or something.
Absolutely.
Right?
And we're focused toward children. So there are times where we ask the children to help us find clues. So there's that different level of interaction
yeah.
in addition to walking through.
Which is really, you know, this is opening up. I mean, here are at least two important conventions of theater that we just sort of bypassed.
Absolutely.
For this production.
And I think that's what is, that was part of our goal in the beginning, to be surprising, to bring people into an experience more than just performance. So they get kind of the best of multiple worlds.
Well, you know, given the celebration of diversity and immigration that is sort of an implied mm-hmm. thread through all this, through the show, it kind of shows you how things can accidentally become political.
Absolutely. It was never our intent, actually, to make plays that were political at all. Our intent was to educate and to enlighten some kind of or excite some kind of a curiosity in children. But I think it's not possible to watch a piece of theater or any piece of entertainment without viewing it through the lens of your everyday life. And right now, so much of our everyday life is centered around this question of immigration.
Yeah.
And I think the plays do a great job of showing the experience of immigrants. And again, with that theme of perseverance. The third play is called Saudade. Which in Portuguese means a longing.
Uh-huh.
And it's set in the Portuguese camp, and it's about some young children who find what they think is a treasure box, and it's locked. They don't know what's inside, and they go from person to person in the camp trying to find out who the box belongs to. And not to spoil it, but they eventually find out that there's a different kind of treasure inside. It's not money. It's not gold. But it's this it's a treasure that's symbolic of the connection between our life today and the homeland that they left to come here.
Managed to get in some pretty good lessons, Ashley. Thank you so much.
I'm excited about it. We've got some amazing playwrights who worked very, very hard to get some lessons, but to hide them under a whole lot of fun.
Sounds that way. Ashley DeMoville is a director of the Leeward Theater production of Plantation Plays at Hawaii's Plantation Village in Waipahu. Be performed weekends in February with showtimes at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. ¶¶
What if Democrats had a crack SWAT team of thousands of candidates and activists? They did once.
The political hack said, let's bottle this thing up. Let's make sure that we control it.
How Obama let a 500-horsepower political weapon get put up on blocks and rust away. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Libraries across the state have become community living rooms for homeless people and those looking for help with their lives. And it's why Hawaii's library system is looking for funds from the legislature to train its employees to better connect patrons to social services. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Libraries have become so much more than just places to borrow books. I mean, you look at them and you can see the people who are truly accessing them as safe havens, at least for many hours of the day, some of them trying to find ways of being able to better their lives. But you got to feel for the employees who really, in many cases, don't know how to cope with all of that.
No, they're not trained for this kind of work. That's the reason the library system wants this outreach program manager. They're looking to get $146,000 over the next 2 years from the legislature to have this position filled. This person would then actually go statewide, help train staff, but also connect libraries with social service agencies to help them, because not only are there people that are homeless, some of them have mental illness, some of them have substance abuse problems, and these are the kind of things that are well beyond the skill set of the library staff. This is a trend, by the way, nationally, particularly with libraries, public libraries, and urban centers across the country. You actually have such a position. Increasingly, they're hiring these same kind of positions in less populated areas, too, given the dire need, really, for help.
We just heard a piece yesterday about the fact that in places where it's very, very cold, a lot of librarians and staffers are coming in early, making coffee, trying to open the doors, get people in so that they're not in the freezing cold. But for us here, where it's not so much the weather, but just being able to connect people to other basic needs, is this position something that is going to be able to network well with what's already existing? I mean, how well does this fit into, for example, what Scott Morshige may have in his mind?
Right. He's the homeless coordinator for Governor Ige. He likes the idea a lot. He wants more collaboration. It really is getting people that are in need in touch with the agencies that can help him. He actually calls libraries touch points. That was his phrase. I should, by the way, just mention, you brought up the weather. In fact, when it gets really hot here and when the fog is bad, libraries serve as very cool places to be because they're all air conditioned. But there's some other problems. Some people are using the bathroom sinks to shower. Leaving behind, in some cases, needles, people that are addicted. So that's the reason security guards have started to be posted. A Hilo Public Library would actually just like to see some medical aid because they're actually handing out bandages to people with open wounds. So it does appear that, well, these are just very good examples of the kind of things that librarians are facing really on the front lines of this issue.
Really, a lot more than just information, but having to render aid.
Right, exactly. And then and staffing is already a problem with libraries. And, you know, the legislature doesn't like to, you know, add positions. They always say, are you using your money wisely? We'll see whether they're able to get what they want. But the need certainly is there.
And when will we know? When does this next come up for, you know, at least in committee?
As you know, at the legislature, anything can change. My guess, it'll be a budgetary item and won't be addressed until the budget is settled, probably in March, is usually when they start to finalize some of those deals. But as you also know, this can go down to the wire in late April.
Okay. Well, for everyone at the library who's trying to cope with this, and we've been out there and we've seen this, it's really difficult, and they don't have enough training to be able to handle it. We'll see what happens. They're doing the best they can.
So are we.
Oh, that's true, too. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you tomorrow.
You too.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat. In Hawaii, Hawaii, centuries of cultural and ethnic blending has diluted the blood quantum in many families with Hawaiian ancestry. That's causing a problem for Hawaiian homeland tenants who would like to pass on their property to a successor, but who could be hampered by the current requirement of at least 25% Hawaiian blood. A bill moved out of committee in the state legislature this week proposes to change blood quantum to 1/32nd. And while that could be helpful, there are other issues with the bill, according to Robin Punani Danner. She's the chairperson of the Sovereign Councils of the Hawaiian Homelands Assembly. She's on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
We talk a lot about, you know, the blending of cultures, the blending of ethnicities, and we look at that in many cases as being a very, very good thing. But doesn't that always also point us back to the idea of, or at least the question, who's Hawaiian?
For some, it does. I think for Native Hawaiians, we know who we are. I think the issue is timely, and actually, as we're coming up on the 100-year anniversary of the enactment of the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, this amendment really honors Prince Kuhio, who wanted 1/32nd in the original version of the bill back in 1921.
Why wasn't that taken into account then?
What a great question, and little known to most in Hawaii. Prince Kuhio advocated, when he was the congressional representative for the territory of Hawaii, for the blood quantum to be 1/32nd, and the merchants, the missionary descendants that had plantations, they advocated for 100% pure blood. And so the Congress split the baby, so to speak, and that's how we arrived at the 50% blood quantum back in 1921.
But the idea of, at that point in time, looking at 1/32nd as being the blood quantum seemed to be rather prescient. I mean, looking at what we're now looking at 100 years later.
Yes, I mean, Prince Kuhio knew what he had a far vision. He didn't make decisions for the moment, but for generations. He thought in terms of generations, and so I'm really excited that we have this opportunity to fulfill one of his dreams, even though it's 100 years later.
That said, there are other parts of the bill, though, that you find inconsistent. Specifically, which parts do you think need to be changed to make it more so?
Yes, there are two major sections of the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, Section 209, which governs the process of successorship at the death of the lessee, okay? And then there's Section 208 that governs successorship while the lessee is alive. So right now, or at least as proposed by the governor, he's willing to advance a bill that says that we can do a successorship to a 1/32nd when we die at death, which for me in this modern world is one of the worst times to be doing asset planning and et cetera. So we are advocating that the governor and the legislature now add in Section 208 to be consistent with the 1/32nd, so that residents in our state, Hawaiians, can plan while they're alive, which is the best time to be doing estate planning, not just for everybody else, but for us too.
We hear so many messages in general about wanting to have control over your assets and being able to make choices, and yet it seems almost strange to think that it's inconsistent with something like Hawaiian homelands.
What do you mean, Beth Ann?
Well, just from the standpoint that, you know, you can turn on your television and see so many commercials about estate planning, making choices, being sure that you're the one that is making those choices and not leaving it to somebody else just as a default mechanism or leaving it to the state. And yet it seems to be so inconsistent with something that was specifically arranged to go to those who had Hawaiian ancestry, that to be able to make choices in that way too.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's very much needed. It's unnecessary to throw families into uncertainty, financial uncertainty, especially during the worst time to be making those decisions, during a grieving cycle. So today, with the one quarter you'd mentioned in your opening, both sections are consistent. So we can do a successorship to a child or grandchild of 25% ancestry in death or in life. And so what we're asking for is for the legislature to follow through on that consistency that they did back in 1999 with this blood quantum lowering, to make sure that it's consistent so that Hawaiian families can plan appropriately just like their neighbors.
Is there anything that you see that needs to be changed so there could be a lateral gift? For example, if you had a grandchild who didn't want it for some reason, could you then, if you're gone, is there any way that that grandchild can gift to another grandchild because they're both grandchildren?
Yes, they can. Right now, under the reading of the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, you can only go straight down. So a child, grandchild, great-grandchild, et cetera. So you can't go lateral at the present time. We do believe at the Shaw, the Homestead Association statewide that we work with, that we do believe that the successorship should be culturally appropriate, and that's genealogy, you know, by family members. That's more of a Western kind of promotion of child to grandchild, whereas our testimony has been we'll take the grandchild, the child and the grandchild, and at least try to expand to sibling, but our preference is to honor what really is here in Hawaii, which is any individual that has a genealogy tie to the original lessee.
And that genealogy could be also, for example, a Hanai child. Does it have to actually be someone whose, you know, family can be directly traced back to that original original lessee?
It would certainly help in that case, because most Hanai, not all, but most Hanai have some familial connection, right? The practice of Hanai is almost always a niece or a nephew or someone in the family conducting the Hanai transactions. So it would certainly address that, although Hanai specifically is not addressed in the law.
Should it be? I mean, just for clarification's sake, I mean, looking back now over 100 years where the idea was originally to have 132nd blood quantum, it seems that this might also be an area or a time at which you could incorporate many of the issues that may face us, not only now, but may face us in future.
It would be fabulous. However, I'm not optimistic about that, especially if we're looking at a piece of legislation that currently right now has such limitations on estate planning and life planning just in this amendment. But it's a major step forward. I will say that. I mean, the homestead associations have been working on this for 5 years. They did listening sessions in 2012 and 2013 to debate the issue of blood quantum internally within our community. And the way that they came out of that was maintain the 50% blood quantum to obtain an original land award from DHHL, but anything after that, which is successorship, should be by genealogy and to the 132nd.
You've said that there's no question that we need to have reform or see reform within the whole area of how Hawaiian homelands are structured and given and then, you know, gifted successively, but how do you see that reform building? I mean, this is clearly one part of that, but if you had your druthers, what do you think needs to happen overall to be able to ensure that this is a productive program that has longevity in a culturally appropriate way?
Well, first and foremost, I think that Hawaiian Homes Commission Act beneficiaries need to be included more in the management and decision making at the state level. And for example, Beth Ann, there's a second bill that's moving through the legislature that restructures the commission. And we have testified on that bill and would like to see amendments to do major reform on the governance structure of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. And that is for the commission to, number one, have a majority of 5 out of 9 commissioners be beneficiaries themselves on the wait list or on the land. Number two, to prohibit the governor's cabinet pick of DHHL director from being on that commission. Right now, that cabinet pick is the chair of the commission, and that is a huge conflict because you have two masters. You have a DHHL director that is whose master is the governor and the politics of that administration, who also controls the commission and sets the agenda. Mm-hmm. And so the commission, by Hawaii administrative rules, requires that they act in the exclusive interest of beneficiaries and not the state. So you have a conflict right there. The state has said, the governor's administration has said, that they don't see that as a conflict, that all other state commissions have their directors be the commission. But shallow view, because they're forgetting that the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act is not a state public trust. It was established by the federal government, and it is not the public that are the beneficiaries of that
trust. And very narrow.
It's named. Yes.
Robin.
And so we
I'd love to talk. I'd love to talk to you.
Be a major step toward reform.
Robin, I'd love to talk to you more about this. It sounds like maybe this should be a town square. There's so much more to this and such a rich conversation. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You bet. Have a great day.
You too. Robin Punani Danner is the chairman of the Sovereign Councils of the Hawaiian Homelands Assembly.
Hi, good morning. I'm Kenny Fink from the State of Hawaii Department of Human Services MedQuest Division. You're listening to member-supported HPR2, live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Tonight at 5, Beth Ann will be bringing us Town Square, looking at an issue regarding rail that has kind of resurfaced in some ways, right?
Yeah, remember 2009?
Yeah.
We kind of had a lot of discussion about this then, too, and even before that, too, the idea was being talked about. And now it's back again. And later on tonight on Town Square, architect Scott Wilson will be joining us. He's been advocating the idea of changing from an elevated system into an at-grade system, now that we already have part which is elevated. Mm-hmm. He's saying, no, there's a hybrid situation we might be able to make out of this that would save us money. Now, a lot of people are questioning that. Many people have come out and saying flat out, no, it's not going to work that way. Certainly, we heard that from Krishnamurti, the interim director of HART. But, you know, just given a time to be able to talk about it, we thought we'd take an hour and let people ask Scott Wilson why he thinks that this is going to work. And we're going to do that tonight. I mean, yesterday with the city council looking at whether or not they're going to keep the rail tax cap going or not.
Yeah.
Clearly, that's saying, no, we don't think elevated rail is going to be it, because they're pretty much committed to what they're doing. But, you know, would there be a change of heart? Literally.
Well, yeah, well, there's always something, at Rosanna Dan used to say.
That's tonight at 5 on Town Square. We hope you'll join us then.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Valentine's Day is coming up, and of course, the traditional way to celebrate is with format changes. So on HPR, starting on Valentine's Day, there will be new lineups on two distinctly formatted stations to bring you more of what you, wait for it, love. See? It's a tie-in. There's more news and more music. You'll find our show, Wait, Wait, along with other entertainment programs on HPR1. Find more information at hawaiipublicradio.org.
And in today's backyard quiz, we asked you about spooky encounters at one of Hawaii's well-known hubs of paranormal activity, Hawaii's Plantation Village in Waipahu. It's an open-air museum showcasing plantation life in the 1800s and 1900s. It's reportedly home to some particularly active ghosts. Young guests have been known to start up conversations with other children that no one else can see. Props in some of the exhibit houses are often moved about inexplicably. And more than a dozen actors have quit the village's annual haunted plantation attraction, citing frightening and unexplained incidents. In one particularly chilling incident, two actors working in the same house on separate nights found small, hand-shaped bruises covering their legs. That house was Hawaii's Plantation Village's Portuguese house, the epicenter of the museum's reported paranormal activity. And that's today's answer. Nobody got that today, but that's our quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
In honor of Valentine's Day, entertainer Willow Chang presents an evening of songs she calls The Seven Faces of Love on Saturday, February 11th in the Atherton Studio. They're beloved tunes from Broadway, jazz, pop, and beyond. Treat yourself and a loved one to tickets by calling 955-8821 during business hours or by going to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Beth Ann, did I hear that correctly? Justine Finn saying that kids are spending 9 hours a day.
Oh yeah,
looking at screens.
Oh yeah, and that's not for homework. That's not homework time.
I didn't think it was. But what is it? I mean, we really don't know that much about it, do we?
Well, we know enough to know that they're spending 9 hours, and they may be doing, you know, they may be talking, they may be texting. I mean, talking via text and
right.
and looking at sites and participating in social media. I mean, all kinds of, as well as, you know, maybe what they're watching in terms of a movie or a show. But the idea that the screen has taken over in so many places. I mean, you get into minivans and there, you know, drops down.
Yeah.
And we tend to rely on screens for a lot of information and a lot of way of managing parenting, too. And she's saying, not such a good idea.
I tend to agree.
Well, that's the idea for today. And we hope you'll come back with us for a few more ideas. Tomorrow, we're going to have an extended conversation with Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors.
And there's an open challenge to the creativity of Hawaii filmmakers.
If you have been listening to us for any time, you know we are moving to HPR 1 starting at 11 o'clock on the 14th. You can just find us on your FM dial at 90.7 for Maui County and for 89.9 for Kauai. If you've got something to say about the time slot or anything else, let us know on our talkback line. That's 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the Conversation page. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you later for Town Square, and we'll both be back with you tomorrow morning, still at 8, right here for the Conversation.